This is Tea Earl Grey Hot, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. There is a tide. Hello and welcome to episode 71 of Tea Earl Grey Hot, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. My name is Yannick, I'm the French guy from Switzerland, and joining me this week is someone whose brain is still floating about in space since it was nerf-pinched and jettisoned out of a window by an overloaded face pistol, as no one really wants to respond to it homing beacon and bring it safely back home. It's my good friend Dave. Good evening, Dave.
That's going to have to go on my CV.
Yes, I'm sure. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you, Yannick. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. We are deep under, 10 feet of snow, something like that. But we're great.
Fair enough.
Good.
Yeah. I wish we could have a bit more than the light smattering of snow we had in this part of the UK, where apparently we're under a yellow alert for snow at the moment, but I've not seen any.
I can send you some if you want.
Please do. Because Alex is gagging to make a snowman.
Cool. We also have a guest with us this week. It's one of last week's guest co-hosts on the Ubuntu podcast. Coming back for the first time, it's Mr. Martin Rimpress. Hello, Martin.
Hello. Thank you for having me back on again. So hearing Dave's weather report, I am very confused because it is so mild down here. I have my window open as wide as I can get my window right now.
Why?
It's warm. It's actually warm down here.
Wow. Well, we are in different climates.
We've had to turn all the radiators down and everything.
Nice. If I opened my window, I'd be frozen in 10 minutes.
Yeah, but you're down in the deep south, so it's kind of not too surprising.
I'm in Hampshire. It's not the deep south. You know, it's not the Isle of Wight.
It is compared to here. It's not the Isle of Wight, no.
Well, I'm further south and I still have tons of snow, so... But I'm higher in altitude, so that may be.
Yes. Yeah, well, we're quite high up. That's probably what it is, actually, because we're kind of at the top of a huge valley, which is probably why we tend to get most of the snow and rain that exists around here.
Anyway, after this nice weather report, and soon we will have a weather report podcast on the Other Side Podcast Network.
Oh, I'll write that one down.
We will review Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 12, There is a Tide. And since it's the last episode before the Great Extravaganza, we will have a chat with Martin about this past season and maybe the next one, as we are not sure Martin will be with us next week. So we'll take the opportunity to talk about this season. So if you guys are ready, let's move on to our review of There is a Tide.
Let's fly.
No, please. So, in the teaser, Discovery, controlled by Ozira and the Emerald Chain, is chased toward Federation headquarters by the Viridian. Ozira directs them to reduce firepower on Discovery to avoid significant damage to the Starfleet vessel. At headquarters, Lieutenant Audrey Wheeler reports to Admiral Charles Vance that a communications jam is preventing contact with Discovery and that the Viridian jumped through the mycelial network with them. Both ships also show residue consistent with being near the Viridian Nebula. Discovery, apparently under attack, is just a few minutes away from entering the shielded area, but Vance is hesitant to allow it entry. I don't know why you would hesitate at this moment. There's no indication that Discovery has been compromised.
Yeah. I kind of got his hesitance because he's got no confirmation that it's not compromised.
Yes, it's that's the jam.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt that was reasonable. In fact, I was very disappointed when we went, okay, allow them in. And I'm like, no, did they not teach you anything at Starfleet? Clearly, you know, did you not study the classics?
Yeah, he clearly didn't watch any of the previous episodes. On Discovery, Kanak reports that the ship's bridge officers have been confined to the ready room and the rest of the crew placed in the brig. Most of Discovery's computer systems have also been converted to chain software, but Kanak reports having difficulty deleting a particular section of the code that, she says, appears to be Ancient Earth Entertainment. We know what that is. The program is using little memory, so Osira tells Kanak to ignore it.
So they've never heard of a virus in 3189 then?
Apparently not.
Right, so this small thing that takes up no memory at all. Nah, just switch it off.
Yeah.
This is the second reference to a Trojan horse in like under 2 minutes in the program on both sides of the agitation.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Osira also orders the Viridian to speed up so as to appear to gain on her. From a station on the side of the bridge, a display shows a pair of eyes watching the proceedings.
That was odd.
Yeah, but I think I recognize a black and white silent movie. And what's the name of the actor I thought I recognized?
Is it Buster Keaton?
Yeah, exactly. That's what right. I thought. So that would be the same virus. That would be that program.
So what I found odd about this is that we know that... this is a vast amount of data, yet they refer to it as taking up very small amount of space, so clearly masking itself.
Yeah, or they made big progress in compression algorithms.
Wow.
The sphere data is not a small part of the memory. It takes a lot of memory in the ship's computer.
No, and it wouldn't be too big of an ask of the sphere data, as intelligent as it seems to be and as sentient as it currently appears to be, to mask itself to look like it's not actually there, or if it is there, just like a small amount of it to be visible.
Mm. Yeah, I guess. Well, obviously, because that's what it did.
Although later on, we do kind of discover that the sphere data is very portable.
Yeah, well, very later on, because this is the last scene of the episode.
Yes.
Spoilers! Spoiler alert. Well, this episode is 1 week old, so... 2 weeks old.
2 weeks old, yes.
It's a classic now.
I'll tell you what, if anybody is listening to this having not watched the episode yet, you're kind of missing the point.
Yes, yes. Well, we're recording this 2 weeks after the episode is... aired, quote unquote, and we're going to take like 3 years to publish the episode. So.
Yeah, it would have been rerun by the time we get this.
In the ready room, regulators attack Rhys when he comments on the ongoing attack. Tilly protests and asks them to release the rest of the crew, saying they need only her as acting captain for leverage. Zare enters with Rin and tells Tilly she should have killed him on the colony instead of leaving the job to the ice, raising his left hand, which is injured and black. He mocks her leadership, noting it took very little time to hijack Discovery. He then tells the regulators that Osira wants the hostages, including Rin, left untouched and leaves. I think they shouldn't have put the... previously on Discovery stuff, because that would have been a great surprise to see him enter the room. Whether there I have said, oh yeah, he's there, but I already seen that in the pre-teaser section.
Television programs are very guilty of doing this, and it's across the board. It's not just American dramas, it's UK dramas and other related programs, where when they do their previously on or last time on, you see things you haven't seen for, I don't know, 6-12 months sometimes. Yeah. And you're like, well, why are they bringing that up now?
Well,
and then about halfway through the episode, you see someone you just saw in the teaser you've not seen for 6 months. And you're like, Why'd you do that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of ruining it. It's like, you know, when they put Brent Spiner in on the credits for the episode of Picard where we...
Oh, before we met, you've even seen him appear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Special guest star, Brent Spiner. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for ruining the surprise. Netflix or Prime, they should have a button. You know, they already have skip credits. They should have a button, skip, I don't know, preview.
They do.
They do?
Yes.
Oh. So,
right at the very beginning of the episode, after it says a Netflix original series,
yeah,
and it says previously on, there's a button in the corner that does say skip recap. So you could skip that bit, which takes you to the beginning of the teaser.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then do the same with the... By the way, I always watch the credits because I love the theme tune. It's one of the best bits of the series.
I haven't seen that button on the Swiss Netflix, but maybe I've
just... Interesting.
Maybe I just didn't see it, you know, because I wasn't looking for it.
Well, it probably doesn't say skip recap. It probably says...
Ignorer le
récapitulatif.
Avancer
les previews or something. Sorry, the what?
Ignorer le récapitulatif, probablement.
Precisely, yes.
Probably.
I was going to say exactly that.
Exactly the words I was grappling for. Thank you, Yannick.
But
although I'm a bit concerned that a button that size wouldn't actually fit on the bottom corner of the screen.
Maybe it's a string overflow error, you know, the string is too long, the internationalization is too long for the space provided, and it just
Tell
doesn't show
it.
Up. You should file a bug, Yannick.
I'm currently translating a certain website, and I have French sentences that are too long.
Maybe they could just shorten it to, I don't know, skip recap or something.
Yeah, some. Yeah, leave it in English, then. Meanwhile, Michael Burnham and Cleveland Booker pilot Booker's vessel through a transwarp tunnel, the same one they suspect Osira used to arrive at the Verubin Nebula so quickly. However, the passage is filled with debris, and even Booker's morphological ship cannot dodge all of it. Burnham says they are 90 seconds from Federation headquarters and warns of the remains of a Wanderer-class ship blocking much of the tunnel. Yeah, like an unmovable object and a unstoppable force.
Did we actually see the Wanderer class ship? Because I was looking out for it and all I saw was like bits of nacelle and stuff.
And special effects and morphing and it was done.
Yeah.
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 But to say that Booker thought he couldn't dodge it, he did a very good job of dodging it.
Dodging it.
So
maybe
I don't know.
Maybe they had a script. And then they didn't follow through on the original script, and they just that got edited down.
He didn't say
probable.
He didn't say he couldn't dodge it. He said he couldn't morph around it, so he actually had to dodge it.
Oh, I see. I'm sure I saw it morph before he went through it, didn't
he? It turned into this long thing, yeah,
yeah,
and then just kind of like darted all the way through.
Yeah, it's still weird stuff for me. This morphing.
Well, it's just the wrong shape. It's supposed to be, I was about to say aerodynamic, but that was a really dull thing to say because there is no such thing as aerodynamics in space. But something that travels sideways on and forwards just seems odd.
May I remind you of a certain species that has cubes as spaceships?
Yes, but that's different because there is literally no right or wrong way for a cube to face in order to propel itself forward.
That's true.
But when you have something that is long, you expect it to travel elongated, not sideways.
Yeah, in space it doesn't matter.
No.
At headquarters, Discovery has entered the distortion zone's gravity well. If they do not open the shields, it will be crushed. Vance orders the shields to open just enough for Discovery to enter and security to stand by. Willow reports that Booker's ship has exited subspace, confusing Vance. Their communications are fried, preventing Burnham from warning Vance not to allow Discovery in. Booker notes that Osira did something similar on Benthos 4, where she got behind the shields and then blew up the presidential palace. With just seconds remaining, Booker's ship flies at high speed into Discovery's shuttle bay, crashing in a fiery landing. Ta-da-da! That was a both brave and completely stupid.
Yes, it's not the first time we've seen a shuttle craft try and land into a shuttle bay while the ship's moving. But this involved a lot more flame and debris and damage. And to be honest, if anything had crashed at that kind of velocity, you'd expect that there would be no survivors.
Right. But isn't this like a space-travelling science fiction trope now that, you know, you can't have a season with spaceships where somebody doesn't land in the shuttle bay? Yeah. It's just like standard fare. They're just going down the tick list of things. Right. Okay, we need the episode.
I remember they did that in the reboot of Battlestar Galactica too.
Yes,
they
had. That's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Yeah.
More than once.
Oh, yeah.
It was a frequent occurrence.
Yeah, well, they got good at it in the end.
I can imagine the producer's discussion. Well, look, our special effects budget, we're not going through it fast enough. So I think what we'll do is we'll have some spaceship landing in the shuttle bay.
And did you notice also that the camera kind of fell on its side?
Yes.
As if the camera was
inside. Been knocked over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I noticed that.
I
noticed a few lens flare effects too.
Yeah, not the lens flares, but the camera falling over is a clever sort of nod to modern culture, though, isn't it? Because, you know, action cameras on, you know, on YouTube videos and all the rest of it are commonplace. You know, there is lots of videos where you see action cameras being overwhelmed, knocked over, tipped upside down. You know, that style of footage is, you know, contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I can't say I disliked it. I liked it. It was a nice landing. But yeah, as you said, at that speed, unless they have some kind of emergency brake or I don't know what, both Discovery and Book's ship should have been destroyed.
Yeah, because I don't imagine the inertial dampeners inside Book's ship would have had much of an effect when the whole thing's lying in about 78 pieces on the ground.
Maybe it can morph into a mattress or something.
That's a good thought. Interesting.
Well, it does have a very large cat, which could be used as a crumple zone.
Well, talking of the cat, talking of the queen, I did notice that Book did check to make sure that, I think the phrase was, grudge is secure.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Don't tell me she's a cat.
She's a cat in her current form.
Yeah.
Whatever that means. I obviously have something to say about that next week. Yes. But it just occurred to me that grudge being secure, she was laying on a bed. How is that secure? Because once you've crashed, cat's going to go, whee!
Cat got 9 lives and always fell on its feet. So
I'm not convinced that cat's got many lives left, to be honest.
This one, probably not, no.
If indeed it is a cat.
It is not. I'm sure it is not. I'm convinced.
I'm sure it's not.
Right, Act 1. With the Viridian holding position outside the Federation headquarters distortion field, Osira is angry that Kanak did not fire upon Booker's ship before it crashed into the shuttle bay. Zare reports that fire suppression protocols are blocking sensors, so they are unable to tell how many people were aboard, but that his regulators will handle whoever arrived. Osira orders him to keep any intruders alive. Now explain to me how it is useful to block sensors when you're trying to mount a rescue mission to save whoever might be alive in the wreckage.
I can't.
I didn't go to Starfleet. I'm not quite sure what the correct answer should be.
Mm.
Because if there's a crash, what you want to do, well, what I would like to do if I was to mount a rescue mission or to go and grab whoever has entered my shuttle bay, would be to know where how many people there is and where they are. So I don't know.
That is an incredibly good point.
Thank you.
Because initially I thought it was the fire suppression, sorry, the sensors of the ship, as in Booker ship, but mm-hmm. we're talking about the sensors within the shuttle bay.
Yeah.
So if the fire's going off, sensors should ramp up, not shut down.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Unless they are broken, but that's not what he said.
No, but we... Where are we?
The beginning of Act 1.
No, I was trying to work out whether we were at the point where the number of life signs would have been suppressed, but we haven't got to that bit yet. So, I can't explain this. It's a really good question.
Don't know. Arriving in engineering, Osira greets an Invigilator Aurelio, a wheelchair-bound human scientist working for the Emerald Chain. He expresses how that the spore drive is a 930-year-old technology, saying it must have been a golden age of science. He reports that it is clear Paul Stamets is a conduit that allows Discovery to navigate the mycelial network, but that he will have to perform a bioanalysis to learn more. He asks if engineering is a safe place to work, and Osira assures him she would never allow him to be harmed. Aurelio says, nonetheless, she seems worried. She tells him she is in hostile territory, about to take the gamble of her life. Aurelio tells Osira she would improve the galaxy by spreading the spore drive technology and freeing ships from having to use dilithium. She asks him to work fast and puts on an Andorian opera before leaving. I was confused by Aurelio's behavior.
I was confused by her behavior towards him.
Yeah, well, the whole package. She suddenly didn't act as we are used to see her acting. She actually cares about this man.
Yes, but in a similar way that Burnham, that Mira Giorgio in the our Mira Giorgio in the Mira universe behaved towards Burnham.
Yeah, it was oversimplification, but it was a mother's love.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
That said, Osira's not the most intimidating Star Trek villain. I've never felt like, it's not like, you know, when the Borg turn up and you think, all right, it's all about to kick off. It's all about to get serious. You know, she's never, I forget the name of the other character. We'll get to him later, but when we get to him, I will make a comparison.
Okay. I understood that. I also thought it was a mother's love or a sister's love, whatever. But what surprised me is that it's the first time we see her like that since we met her a few episodes ago. I mean, the first time we saw her, she killed her nephew.
this is true, yes.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, okay, true. Is this artistic license because the actor playing that character was sort of written in to this episode, you know, as a result, because he's previously played characters in earlier seasons of Discovery.
About four or five different characters this season, and he's been in other series as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that. I didn't study my trivias.
Well, I have one less trivia item to mention at the end of the show. So
oh, sorry.
Be thankful for that. No, it's absolutely fine.
Every week. It's less...
it's good, though. It is.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, we find out a little bit more about their history a bit later on. Mm-hmm. Janet Kidder, she's a great actress. I've got no issue with her at all. But she seems to forget where she's from. Her accent is bouncing around between North American and British.
Yeah, sort of mid-transatlantic, mid-sentence. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she is American, so you'd expect her to have an American accent, but her accent in places is incredibly British.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking Kelly LeBrock British.
Yeah, I haven't noticed that, so it's a good thing we have at least one British citizen on this podcast every week.
And the listeners can write in and tell us who that is.
In the shuttle bay, DOT-23 drones have nearly extinguished the fires on and around Booker's damaged ship. Booker reports that Grudge is safe and secure and gives Burnham another dose of radiation medication, which causes lesions on her face to heal. A little bit too quickly to my taste, but...
I want what she's having.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Yannick, for sure.
It happened last week as well, on last week's episode, when they were giving the anti-radiation medication to the guys on the Kiev.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, you know, they can't spend 8 weeks recovering from those injuries, or otherwise they will be on that for the whole season. So, Burnham says their first goal should be to find Stamets, as Osira cannot jump the ship without him. However, Booker tells her she will have to act alone. He has just one device that can conceal her life signs from sensors. Oh. Burnham suggests that they still stick together, but Booker disagrees, arguing that they will expect to find at least one pilot, and that Burnham is more familiar with Discovery, and thus better able to move about without being detected. Burnham confesses she's in love with Booker. He says he's love her too, they kiss, cue violins, etc., etc., etc. And lose a ton of time. Yeah, I love you too. Blah, blah.
No, you hang up. No, you hang up.
You hang up. Okay. You haven't hung up.
Oh, you hung up.
Burnham departs just before Zari detects Booker's life sign and orders him taken alive. Those two, they're always find the worst moments to, you know, to get together.
Young love.
Yeah. At headquarters, an officer reports that Discovery is jamming transporters, while Villa notes that the Viridian is simply waiting outside the shield perimeter. Vance wonders aloud why Osira would only bring one ship when she knows part of the fleet is at Kaminar. Realizing that Osira has hijacked Discovery, Vance orders all Starfleet vessels to go weapon hot and prepare to fire on the ship. At last.
Ah. So, actually, the penny's just dropped, because I thought that the chain fleet going to Kaminar was to try and get Saru, or to get the Discovery over there so that they can attack them. I didn't realize it was actually to get Discovery out of the way.
I think it was, you know, either or. Either Discovery went to Kaminar and they could have taken it there, or the fleet, and then they stole Discovery.
I suppose. Yeah. Yeah, ignore me.
Yes, as usual. Zare escorts Booker to the ready room with the bridge crew and Rin, and punches him in the stomach before leaving. Tilly looks at Booker, who silently indicates with his eyes that Burnham is also aboard somewhere. That was not discreet.
Not in the slightest.
Anyone could see that. Mm. It was like, yes, yes.
Psst.
Psst. Hey, she there. Yes, she there. Okay, good. I mean, the word was absolutely of use.
Totally. I just want to talk for a second about this budding bromance between Zara and Book. Because there seems to be they have a kind of a connection. You know, the kind of connection where they clearly want to kill each other, but they want to court each other first.
Well, we know how that ends.
Well, we do, most certainly. But I just thought the fact that they clearly wanted to cause each other damage, but were quite happy to flirt in the lead up to it, a foreplay, if you like, I found that quite funny.
Yeah, yeah. At the memorial wall in a corridor, Burnham attacks a regulator who was trying to pry a badge off the wall. He manages to stab her in the left leg, but Burnham subsequently suffocates him with her legs, which is a great feat, you know, having a knife in one of her leg. Did she suffocate him so he passed out, or did she kill him? I don't know.
It wasn't long enough to kill him, but for the purposes of this,
I think
I don't want to get all you know, morose about this, but usually when you see people strangling people on drama shows, it takes seconds, you know, 10, 15 seconds at the most, but I'm pretty certain it takes a little bit longer than that.
Yeah.
You can put your murder gloves away now.
Burnham pulls out the knife and uses the regulator's combadge to attempt to beam away, but it is blocked by the jamming field. Her leg bloody, Burnham hobbles away. And when I saw the blood stains on the ground, I thought, yeah, you're leaving a trail, you're going to get caught in a few seconds.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention that, because I thought, we're being let in on something here. Look, we're being shown the trail of blood. This is going to be relevant later.
Yeah, but... Mm. Yeah, not this time.
You thought she would have known as well.
Yeah.
It was an unnecessary little pan, because they didn't use it. It was evident that she'd been stabbed. They didn't need to do that whole, you know, typical, oh, look, there's the blood, here's the trail of blood, and they're walking away now. Did you catch the bit where she got stabbed and here's the blood and we're walking away now? It was unnecessary.
Yeah.
Yes, I've got it, okay. Was it Einstein, or I may be misattributing here, that said the definition of madness is the act of doing the same thing multiple times and expecting a different result?
Yeah, I think it's Einstein.
It was somebody, yes.
Right.
I've heard that.
So Burnham had this comm badge, and she went, beep, and it didn't work. So she went, beep, and it didn't work again. So she went, beep, 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 beep. It's not working.
No.
I think we can attribute that to the adrenaline on account of being stabbed in the leg.
Yeah. Oh, that's just an excuse.
I'm a Burnham apologist. I apologise for that.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I love Burnham when she's not whispering.
Or face-sucking, you know, because...
Yes.
The USS Song and other vessels take offensive stations around Discovery, and Vance warms the fleet near Kaminar to brace for retaliation. Osira hails Vance via hologram. He directs her to surrender or to be fired upon, but Osira apologizes for arriving under pretenses and asks to talk. She releases most of the ship's crew on shuttles as a good faith gesture, but holds on to the bridge crew for leverage. So you hijack a ship, you put the bridge crew under arrest, you assign everyone else to quarters, you force your way through a shield, and then, as a gesture of good faith, you release the crew. I mean, I'm not sure the good faith is in order there.
No.
I have thoughts for later.
Oh, okay. So put a pin on those and...
I will.
In a Jeffrey's tube, Burnham uses a device to cauterize her stab wound. She hears over the comm badge that Osira has left the ship for the Federation headquarters. She then issues a distress call to Gabrielle Burnham on Nivar, reporting on the situation and asking her mother for help. She then overhears that Aurelio is with Stamets in engineering. I was like, why would she call Nivar? I mean, if there is a communication jam, she probably can't get out anyway. And if she can, why doesn't she call Vance? Just like calling her mom. Mommy, there's a bad guy on my ship.
Can't answer that.
Yeah.
Unless she's using some hidden sub-channel thing that still exists that no one else happens to be listening to at the time.
Except
so I would have thought that if she tried to contact Vance directly, then Osira may have picked up on it.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Like,
another good question. Don't know.
I have plenty of good questions and no answer whatsoever.
Well, it's no good then, is it?
Well, we're on to Act 2. Vance and Willa welcome Osira and several Regulator's bodyguards to Federation headquarters. Bond says that the Federation president has authorized him to negotiate for the release of Discovery and its crew. Bond also notes that they will respond with force should the Emerald Chain initiate hostilities and escort Sosara to a conference room. That was not so subtle. She didn't say anything. She didn't have time to move on, and he was already threatening to retaliate. So,
but he did start that particular threat by saying that he would not tolerate any hostile action by any member of Starfleet. But
yeah,
if they initiated them, then you're out of here.
Yeah, game on.
Game on.
In the conference room, Rhys and Bryce are covertly tapping out communications in Morse code. One of the guards notices and orders them to stop, but they do not. Owo angrily tells them to stop, prompting Detmer to chastise her in turn. The ensuing commotion distracts the guards, and the crew attacks and neutralizes them. And I was, when they started, you know, fighting at each other, I was like, yes, yes, it's gonna be fight. Booker asks what the tapping was, and they tell him all officers learn Morse code in their first year at the Starfleet Academy.
Why?
I don't know why you wouldn't know Morse code. I mean, it's kind of international.
Because there's a 930-year gap between
their
worlds.
He's got a ship that morphs. He doesn't need, you know, a centuries-old analog communications mechanism.
True.
His computer can probably translate it for him on the fly anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Rhys reveals he merely told Bryce via code to keep tapping. I'm using Booker. Tilly is locked out of the computer, but Rin offers to hack the system. Booker reveals that Culber and Saru remained behind in the nebula. Lieutenant Ina notes that they have little time left before succumbing to the radiation, but Booker informs them that Adira took extra medication down to them, buying some time. Tilly says they will jump back to rescue them after retaking the ship. She orders Bryce to monitor communications, Owo, Detmer, and Rhys to open a door leading to the maintenance shaft, and the rest to barricade the turbolift doors.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah, I thought Tilly was like, she seemed to be a little bit, how can I say that? She had maybe lost her panache when she was taken out of the captain's chair, but suddenly she's back in control. She's the leader of the team again.
Mm.
And it was good to see.
Yeah, she responded well to the circumstance. Again, proving that whatever the decision was made, rightly or wrongly, for her to act as first officer, it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I agree. Osira asks Vance why the holographic Dr. Eli has joined their negotiations. He tells her they employ biometric lie detectors during such negotiations. Osira says she does not intend to lie, which Eli confirms. Vance asks to speak to the officers remaining about Discovery, but Osira instead turns to Eli and states that they are unharmed except for minor injuries, which Eli confirms. Osira brags that it was easy to take Discovery, in part because Saru was not present, and asks if he was sent to Kaminar. Vance ignores her question and asks what she wants. Osira says she wants the Emerald Chain to unite with the Federation, surprising Vance. And me.
And me.
And me.
What?
That's the last thing that was on my mind when she started that conversation. I don't know what I was expecting her to say, but it certainly was not that.
No.
I was expecting her to say, I demand your surrender.
Something along those lines, yeah.
Not. Well, we'll get to the later bit. Carry on, sorry.
She says the chain's dilithium is running out, but that her scientific resources could replicate the spore drive technology. Vance asks why she needs the Federation, as she has already taken control of Discovery, and Osira says that despite its failures since the burn, the Federation still represents hope to many, while the chain does not. And I was even more surprised that she actually recognizes that, and I was completely lost.
Yes. I agree. The preceding actions are incompatible with this conversation and the one that follows.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Martin. I make a note later on in the conversation between the two of them that kind of it places my analysis of the entire situation and the conversation they have somewhere between over their hair and over there. Because on the one part, she's coming across as sincere. Eli is confirming that she's telling the truth. But there's something else there that just isn't quite right. She may well be telling the truth, mm-hmm. but she also might be omitting stuff.
Yeah, the feeling I had was that she was actually meaning everything she said, that she wanted the chain to join the Federation and all that. But I just couldn't stop thinking she has an ulterior motive. There's something she needs that, to get it, she needs the Federation and the chain to be together.
And right.
I just couldn't find out what, but...
I presume it's dilithium.
No, I thought it was something else. I don't know why. Just a feeling like that. The dilithium it's not even a pretext. It's reality. Everybody's running out of dilithium. So it's true that both together they would be stronger with the chain's scientific means that they have and the Federation with the image it has. So. Everything she said, it makes sense, actually. But I just couldn't help thinking she had something else in mind. But, yeah, I guess...
Well, you can be forgiven for thinking that on account of the fact that she's just perpetrated an elaborate, you know, invasion and subterfuge. You know, there is nothing trustworthy to make you think, oh, yeah, it seems like a reasonable request. Yeah. You're such a lovely lady.
and the fact that she said to Aurelio that she was about to play the gamble of her life. So she's gambling on something. We don't know. We just don't know why.
We don't know what. Yeah.
What?
But had she gone through the diplomatic channels and requested an audience with Vance to negotiate joining with the Federation, I don't think they would be talking. I think they would just be dismissed.
Yeah. Possibly.
This is the only way she could have had this conversation with Vance, by effectively forcing a way in.
Yeah.
It's not an unreasonable, you know, position. I mean, I did wonder the same thing, but you'd think that you would have investigated other avenues before you go for an all-out onslaught.
Yeah.
Desperate times, desperate measures, possibly.
Yeah, but the whole crew of the Osiris crew, they all seem to be okay with the plan, and I'm pretty sure that what's his name, the guy with the they met on the colony previously. I already forgot his name, but I'm pretty sure he doesn't want to join the Federation. I'm pretty sure the regulators and all the other crew, they don't. I don't feel like they want to join the Federation. So that's, if Osira was going there to negotiate a joining, they would stop her, I guess. It's not like it's a military organization. They would just say, well, we don't agree with you, go away.
Right. That's a good explanation. Zara was the person you're thinking of.
Yes.
No, that's a good explanation. Because they would have tried to stop her.
I think they would.
No, I think you're right. When Osira first mentioned that she wanted the chain to join with the Federation, Vance said something really odd. He said that the end result of this would be the formation of a new Federation, consisting of the old Federation and the Emerald Chain. But wouldn't the Federation in its current form invite the Emerald Chain to join it, rather than creating a new Federation from the two components?
Well, maybe this is a little bit of the rub, right? That they don't want to give up their identity. They want to be recognised as an equal partner or an instigator in this alliance. not being subservient to the Federation.
I guess the chain is a very large organization, so it's not like, you know, the Federation, a planet or a system of planet joining the Federation would be a small entity joining the big Federation entity. Here it would be two big entities joining together. It's like when a company buys a company that's roughly its size. Sometimes they change merge. The name, yeah. They merge and yeah. Things like that.
Is it like, you know, countries choosing to work together and collaborate, you know, or maybe the inverse of that after many, many decades of, you know, intercompany collaboration that, you know, one of them decides to break away, you know, go its own way, forge its own path.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yes.
Meanwhile, Kanak has discovered the regulator attacked by Burnham, and Zare summises someone else using a life-sign concealment device must be aboard. He traces the regulator's com badge to Burnham's location in the Jeffrey's tube. And yes, no use of the blood trail. I'm disappointed.
I'm surprised because they made such a big deal of following it when she got up and stabbed the communicator device that didn't work. And then kind of hobbled to her feet and walked away. The camera followed the blood trail. So I'm really surprised.
Yeah. And also, how can he locate the com badge with the communication jam?
Because this was an Emerald Chain com badge. Oh. And the Emerald Chain comms were still working.
Okay, true. Gotcha. In engineering, Stamets has been handcuffed to a railing and Aurelio removes the neural locks that the chain used to control him and force Discovery to jump. Awakening, Stamets notes they are listening to Andorian opera. Aurelio explains that Andorian makes the best opera singers because their antennae increase resonance. Stamets remarks he would like to hear the performance in person someday, and Aurelio tells Stamets that Osara would surely want a scientist of his talents at a science institute. Stamets asks if Aurelio's children like opera, noting that he has three silver piercings behind his right ear, an Orion symbol to bless the arrival of a new child. Now that made me think. Aurelio, children, Osara, the way she acts with him. I thought maybe, you know, Osara was the mother of Aurelio's children?
That never even occurred to me.
No, that didn't enter my thoughts either. I felt like he had his own family and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Don't know. It's just something that occurred to me. That the way she acts with him, I don't know.
I think Aurelio is a, for want of a better phrase, a rescue child.
Yeah.
Where Osira dug him out of a deep, dark pit, set him on a chain of events that brought him to where he is now. That's the only thing I can think of, and that's why there's this affection between them.
Yeah, that's my interpretation.
Trying to connect with Aurelio, Stamets says he has a child himself, apparently referring to Adira. And I was like, what? Wait? And I also thought about Adira, but I was, well, you've got a child? We don't know that. Aurelio tries to turn the discussion to the spore drive, but Stamets continues to talk about Kelber, who, he notes, is in danger inside the Verubin Nebula. Aurelio speculates that the tardigrade DNA in Stamets is how he controls the spore drive, but Stamets tells him the species has gone extinct and cannot be replicated. He will have to be killed to extract it, but Aurelio assures him they instead will grow the tardigrade cells. So the technology to duplicate cells has evolved, and it's both good thing and bad thing. It's a good thing because Stamets doesn't have to die, but it's also, you know, bad thing at this moment when you think about what Osara can do if she had a lot of spore drive ships. I was like,
not just that, but Stamets would become redundant, and therefore they would have no further need of him.
Yes. So that doesn't sound very good.
No, it does not.
Although Aurelio seemed to be not be keen to violence. So that was also a good point for
Stanley. I think the difference yeah. there is that Aurelio seems to be quite a level-headed, decent human being, whereas Asaira is not.
So I would agree, right? So he portrays himself as, well, compassionate, among other things. And Asaira is a confused mix of characters and emotions. There's points at which I find her to be thoughtful and wanting to represent the greater good, and then on the other hand, a warlord.
She might have multiple personalities.
It's possible. I mean, she does come across as incredibly intelligent.
Yeah.
And yet sometimes really stupid.
Well, I guess you have to be intelligent if you want to run the... well, I don't know if she runs the Emerald Chain, because she refers to a council or something like that. So she probably doesn't run it, but she might be one of the top executives.
She talks later about, you know, how much political capital she's had to trade in order to make these things happen.
Yeah.
So she's at the top, but I don't think she's in charge, because she's had to make compromises.
Kallak and other regulators are approaching Manham's position in the Jeffreys tube. Rin has gained access to the ship's systems, and Tilly tells him to scramble communications to help Burnham. Meanwhile, Burnham ties herself to a railing inside the tube. Just as Kallak grabs her, Burnham uses a phaser to destroy a sensor, fooling the computer into thinking there is a fire. The ship's fire suppression system opens the tube to space to remove the oxygen. Kallak, holding onto Burnham's boots, is eventually blown into space. Burnham's strap fails, but the exterior vent closes before she is ejected. Of course it does. I had no doubt, but it's still pretty dramatic. Well, it could have been a little bit more dramatic if she would have been blown out into space and then, you know, in few seconds grabbed by something, or she would have grabbed something and get back into the ship. But I guess they didn't have time for that.
Yeah, either that, because she's got this device on her arm that can, like, form a phaser. Maybe it would kind of kick into life and put a space helmet on her.
Yeah, or something.
She'd still freeze, but, you know, she could breathe.
Yeah. When? there's an episode of something. I think it's an episode of Star Trek where they do that. They shoot someone in space and then they grab that person after a few seconds.
Oh, you're thinking of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah, no, it's Guardians of the Galaxy, yes, thank you. Thank you. On the bridge, Zari watches the dead Kallak floating in space. A barefoot Burnham emerges from the Jeffreys tube and tells Zari over comms that he will need more regulators, to the relief of Booker and the crew. That reminded me of Die Hard when...
so much. I mean, yeah. They could have just shifted the whole set to Nakatomi Plaza at this point. You know, absolutely, and had a yippee-ki-yay.
Yeah. Burnham ditches the comm badge and runs off. And that's the end of Act 2.
Yay.
Yay.
Just quickly jumping back to the line that said on the bridge, Zero watches the dead Kallak floating in space. Slight inaccuracy. It's Zero watches a number of pieces of the dead Kallak floating in space.
That's true. So, Act 3. Vance presses Asaira to make her point. She tells him that if they are to join forces, the Federation must send a message that the Chain's culture is valid and ethical by acknowledging that capitalism is already happening within the Federation. She notes it has been 87 years since anyone from the Federation visited Deep Space 253, a distant outpost. However, Deep Space 253 has been trading with the Chain Mercantile for nearly a century, and that trade should be sanctioned, Osara says. The chain should also be allowed to set up an embassy on the station. Vance protests, arguing that the mercantiles traffic in goods used for enslavement, and some even have open slave markets. Osara says she has submitted a charter amendment to the chain's congress to outlaw slavery. It has enough support to pass, though she had to expend a great deal of political capital. And once again, I was like, what? Why would she do that? She seemed genuinely concerned by that. She seemed really honest, for lack of another word. And yet I just couldn't believe it.
It does seem to me as though whomever she is, she does seem to have quite a bit of clout amongst whoever her people are.
Mm-hmm.
So whether she is deemed... She may well be a politician. That would explain a lot, actually. She may be a politician. She may be a fairly high-flying politician. She certainly wouldn't be the leader of her, whether we call it a race or a species or whatever it is. Of course, it's not, is it? Because she's Orion, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
So, of her organisation. So, I don't know. She's just really good at what she does. We just don't know what that is.
She's the best Minister of Transport you could ever hope to have.
So by saying, you know, her being a politician would explain everything, you mean that would explain why she says something at one moment and the complete opposite at the next moment?
Right. And also,
pretty much,
why she had a watertight, well-drafted, you know, cordial agreement as to how these two organisations that have been vehemently opposed to one another could find a way to, join forces.
Mm-hmm. But it's also the fact that we know that she's lying through her teeth, but she believes she's telling the truth, and Eli agrees. So she's a politician.
Do we know that she's lying?
She's got to be.
We do, because she is green, and all science fiction characters that are green are not to be trusted. And it's a law or an old charter or something.
Except Hulk. The Hulk.
Can't be trusted.
Yeah, well, he's an Avenger.
Yeah, I know, but can't be trusted.
Okay. That's a good point. Yeah, well, we do know because of everything we said earlier, but we don't... we feel that she's lying. We don't know that for a fact. We just feel it.
What I found interesting about this is that I'd been wondering if Vance was going to be a bad man all the way through the season so far. And it was in these exchanges that he solidified his place as, I'm the good guy and I'm talking to the bad guy right now. And it was only up to this scene that I was convinced of the fact that he was the good guy.
Well, we've established from earlier episodes that when we first met Vance, we were not convinced that he was going to be one of those good officers, you know, those good admiral. But yeah, he kind of grew on us.
Yeah, he has done. But it was only this exchange where I was convinced of the fact that, okay, you're all right. I trust you, and I don't trust you because you're green.
That's discrimination.
You're colorist.
Well, no, it's a stereotype. It's a stereotype of science fiction.
Okay. Okay. That's okay because it's science fiction.
Right.
I was about to say Beast Boy from Teen Titans, but no, you can't trust him either.
I'm gonna put this theory out there to be knocked down. You know, there's bound to be one outlier, but you know, as a general rule of thumb, if alien green equals cannot be trusted.
Okay.
Well, you have just supplied our call to action on our website for this episode. Yes. So appreciate that. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Less work for me.
Vance tells Osara they would also require the chain to release Quajan and other pre-warp planets under its influence. She says he is asking powerful people to give up significant income. But Vance retorts that she could explain it to them by hijacking their ships and breaking through their shields. Funny guy.
Also, definitely a politician.
Yeah.
the first sentence there. Classic politician.
It has to be, being an admiral of Starfleet. I mean, they don't put men of action as admirals, you know.
Right. Or no, retired these are men of negotiators. Action. They're skilled in the gab.
Yeah, yeah. Wheeler and a regulator arrive to deliver the news that the bodies of several regulators have been detected in space around Discovery. O'Sara, seeking to advance negotiations, provide Vance with a copy of a proposed armistice. Fully written and all that.
I know.
Yeah. Among other things, it would require the chain to follow the primary directive moving forward. What? More and more surprises.
Yeah.
O'Sara commits to a 15-year walkback of control over Quajan and the other worlds, arguing that an immediate pullout would cause chaos. Vance sits down to read the full document. I mean,
15
who reads?
Years?
Yeah.
Does that mean they would withdraw in 15 years?
Within 15 years, yeah.
Yeah, over that. It's a bit like, wow. You know, the environmental policies of the modern day. It's like, well, let's make it look like we want to do something about it by saying we'll do it by 25 years from now, and we can just keep pushing back and pushing back.
Yeah.
Whereas all they've done is thrown a dartboard, and chosen that particular number.
Yeah. Well, as she said, he's asking powerful people to give up, you know, a lot of income. So. Yeah. I was surprised she would actually accept to do that.
And it's reasonable, right? Because they need a good 15 years to find other exploitative practices in order to recoup the money they're going to lose from this arrangement.
Especially if they have to find those ways to get their money back within the confine of the new Federation.
Mm. Right. Holodecks are us.
Holodecks are us.
Yeah, using years, well, it's something I've wondered since I've been watching Star Trek, you know, when they give them, you have 3 hours, that we talked about that on previous
we
episodes,
have done.
That doesn't mean anything for any alien, so.
No, it doesn't, but there are two possibilities. Firstly, they're doing it for the fans. Yeah. That kind of makes sense, because it's something they can relate to. But also, the Federation is still predominantly human, even after all this time. Yeah. And humans know what... Well, I say that, they probably don't. Humans knew what hours and days and years were. But what's a day? It's when the sun travels around the Earth. How far from Earth are they right now?
Yeah. So
that's a fantastic point, because we're 1,000 years on, right? I wonder what that's done to circadian rhythm, not being subjected
goodness.
To, you know, the 24-hour cycle for that amount of time, if you've evolved into a different, you know, natural cycle.
Wow.
Well, it's like on the Enterprise. I mean, they had day and light cycles, 24-hour cycles.
Yeah.
Artificial cycles, of course.
That would account for it. Yes, it's artificially, you know, sustained.
Yeah.
So this now makes me want to go and speak to our resident astronomer and ask him, from where we are now to 3198, knowing how much the Earth is currently slowing down in its spin.
Ooh,
how long a day
would be
is going to be in 3189.
How many seconds?
I look forward to learning together.
Andrew?
Yeah, Andrew, please.
If you're listening, please come back to us.
Mm.
Are you going to try to reach Andrew while we are recording this show and drag him in there to answer the question?
I was going
to
write it down on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Which is the very next best thing.
How about you write it down on Telegram?
Okay. I will write it down on Telegram, because if we can get an answer for it while we're still recording, that would be amazing.
That would be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Andrew, call 115-6162. You will be live. You will be live. But also, you know, they're in the middle of negotiation, and she hands Vance a document, and he sits down and starts reading.
I think that was more to as much to wind her up as it was
Probably.
To actually find out what it represented.
It's probably the only one reading the fine prints on those documents. Mm. He actually read the F manual.
Yes.
So while we are trying to get in touch with Andrew, let's move on. In the ready room, Rin says that he cannot block their life signs, but he can scramble them so that sensors show all life signs that have been on the ship in recent months, making it appear like there are thousands of people aboard and allowing the bridge crew to move free. That's a very poor sensor and a very poor security on the sensor to be able to make them think there's a thousand people by showing up all life signs from the past.
Yes, the future disappointed me with their inadequate security controls at this point.
Yeah.
It always does.
It's like, you know, like in the previous episode, everybody beaming on Discovery's bridge without any problem.
Yeah. I'm having flashbacks to Picard as well when all of those pop-up adverts appeared in the
front. Right, yes, when they were approaching the
whatever post, planet it was. Yeah.
Oh no, it was the planet, wasn't it? When what's her face? I've forgotten her name again.
It's where Seven went Tonto.
Right, yes. Where what's her face went to meet her son.
Yes. That's right.
We worked this one out last week. I like the one already. Michelle Hurd's character.
Yeah, that's her.
Raffi.
Raffi.
That's
yes.
Well
Raffi.
Done. Yes. Well
Thank
done.
You. Well done.
I've had a response from Andrew.
Yeah.
No way.
He's got to go and check and do some sums. So we might actually have an answer for the end of this show.
Nice, nice.
They're not just going to be sums. I believe the correct expression is hard sums.
Is that alcoholic sums?
Oh, no, those are easy sums because you can always justify them with, you know, fanciful, you know, misinformation.
Rin and Booker volunteer to remain behind to fight off the regulators that come looking for them. Booker tells Tilly that she represents Burnham's best chance. Rin scrambles the sensors, confusing Zare, as the rest of the crew escape. And I thought, when they both stayed behind, I thought, that's going to be the end of them. Because, you know, so usually when someone does that in one of those series of movies, they're holding the fort for a few minutes and then they're gone.
Mm.
So I was a little bit sad.
I see why, but my mind wasn't going there at that point. I thought that they had another role to carry out. I did like the exchange between Tilly and Book.
Yeah.
Where she was doubting herself because he was staying behind. Whereas actually he was staying behind because he trusted her.
Right, yeah.
So the exact opposite.
Exactly, that's what he said. In engineering, Aurelio assures Stamets that the regulators are well-trained and will sort whatever the problem is. Well, isn't it Chuck Norris that does that? You know, when there's a problem, Chuck Norris always solves the problem.
Chuck Norris, MacGyver.
Yeah, kind of. Stamets notes Osira hijacked the ship and has taken hostages, including himself. But Aurelio says she is negotiating to bring spore drive technology to the entire galaxy. He tells Stamets that while he may not like her methods, she is more than you're making her out to be. I was forced to agree with that because, it's definitely not the Osira we knew. So, but I was still confused. Aurelio explains that his genetic defect would have left him dead long ago, but for the intervention of Osara when he was 10 years old. There we go.
Same as
what Mirror Jojo did to Mirror
Burnham
in the Mirror universe.
Yes.
Stamets says he has evidence of the science she supports, such as the pesticide on Quajan. Aurelio cites the pesticide as a triumph, but Stamets reveals to him she provided it to the Quajan in exchange for hunting transworms, almost to extinction, while threatening their population, concerning Aurelio. Stamets also reveals Burnham barely escaped one of Osara's labor camps, further shocking Aurelio. Just then, Burnham arrives, stuns several guards and Aurelio, and frees Stamets from his bindings. Ta-da-da!
Mm-hmm.
I struggled with this.
Why? It was too easy?
No. Aurelio is not a young man. Mm-hmm. How has he had the wool pulled over his eyes for so long and not seen the true nature of Asyra?
The other question is, why does Asyra look significantly younger than he is?
Because she's green.
Orion? She's green.
Because she's green. Nice.
It does wonders for your complexion.
So it's cream she puts on every morning, you know.
Yeah. A little avocado face pack goes a long way.
Yeah.
Finished off with the aloe vera.
Yeah, yeah, you've got it, Dave. I can see you're a subscriber to the aloe vera face rub.
Yeah. Actually,
I'm not being facetious.
No, you're not. No, I do use aloe vera. I'm not particularly cosmetically inclined, but I do recognise the benefits of aloe vera. That's why my face is so supple.
It's why you've got those baby fresh good looks.
Wow, it's really nice to know that my efforts are, you know, appreciated. So thank you, Martin.
Yeah, for the benefit of the listeners, Dave is looking baby fresh right now.
With a beard. A bearded baby.
Yeah, I can see how that would confuse things slightly.
Meanwhile, regulators finally break into the ready room and begin exchanging fire with Booker and Rain. Putting on a new pair of boots, Burnham says she must get Stamets off the ship, but he protests while reloading a new canister of spores into the drive, so they can jump back to the nebula to save Culbert and Saru. Burnham reveals Adira is also in the nebula, causing Stamets to become even more frantic. Unable to convince him, Burnham resorts to using a Vulcan nerf pinch to incapacitate him.
Yeah.
Yay. So she hasn't lost all of her Vulcan training after all.
No, although it seemed, I don't know, it seemed a bit kind of half-baked, the Vulcan nerve pinch. It was kind of a, rather than a proper pinch.
Yeah, it was more like a chiropractor sorting out a, you know, frozen shoulder.
Right. Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
Well, it's very cool that she managed to do it. She's not Vulcan, and this Vulcan nerf, which is supposed to be a Vulcan thing, hence the name.
Well, exactly.
But we already said that when Archer was possessed, quote unquote, the ancient Vulcan.
Sirak.
Sirak. I was
Sirak?
I had Sarek in my mind, but no. Yeah, I think it's Sirak. Mm. Something. Yeah,
Sirak. Or
and he.
Yeah.
He made a Vulcan nerve pinch, and we already wondered how, as a human, he would be able to do it. But hey, they can apparently.
I just feel like people should be flailing about and whelping in pain when, you know, the pinch is in full effect.
Yeah.
You know, they just sort of wither.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you've got a nerve somewhere that is pinched, it hurts like hell.
Exactly. I've had pinched nerves in my neck and back.
Yeah.
I did not go quietly.
No. No, I know.
But would Vulcans do something that they knew would actually bring someone pain?
Oh, I see. Mm. Probably not. No, they totally would. They can't be trusted either.
Right. I want to make the first of two shout-outs to a particular actor. Okay. I felt this week that Anthony Rapp was absolutely on point with his acting this week. the way he reacted when he found out that Adira was in the nebula as well, his increased hysterity. That's not a word, is it? His increased hysterics and his franticness in, you know, trying to persuade Burnham that he needed to jump. I don't know. I was really impressed by him.
Yeah, they'd set out that Adira is obviously considered, you know, a child to them, and he behaved like his character behaved like a parent in this situation.
But he had already adopted, in quotes,
yeah,
Adira as his child, and Hugh as their other dad.
Yeah,
over the last few weeks, so it's not unexpected behavior.
No,
in that same circumstance, well, I'd probably react the same way.
Yeah, I agree. So we're on to Act 4 now. As Vance reads the armistice, O'Sara asks who Eli is modeled after. Vance tells her his image was computer generated. He finishes reading and calls the armistice very impressive, noting it made many concessions. But he has one further question: who would represent the chain to the Federation? O'Sara agrees that her reputation precludes her from being the diplomatic representative, and that she would choose someone appropriate, perhaps a well-respected scientist. And I thought, maybe Aurelio.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, maybe someone that's not green.
You're not letting this go, are you?
No.
She insists the person would be free from her influence, but Eli says it was a lie.
Without missing a beat, it's immediately she says that, he's like, that's not the truth.
Yeah, well, it's a nolo, so, you know. Vant says that for the armistice to work, O'Sara would have to be tried for her crimes, shocking her. She tells him he's stuck in the past when she has offered a map to the future. The past is the only light with which we can see the future, Vance responds. Unable to agree on this final point, O'Sara walks away angrily. You know, it's a completely valid point, but with everything that happened so far, this seems a bit odd that she would not agree on that. She made a lot of efforts. It made me think that either everything was a pretense and then she had now some reached the point where she would do what she really came to do. Or, I don't know, maybe she was willing to do anything that did not implicate herself in her person in that. I mean, she would agree on the chain respecting the Prime Directive, the chain, you know, stopping slavery and everything, because that didn't impact her directly. But then being tried for a crime, that maybe she didn't expect that. And then, I don't know, that was something, again, something that let me think that she had something else in mind, and that she was now going to do that. I don't know. Maybe, you know, getting back to Discovery and starting and opening fire on the headquarters or something. I don't know. But there was something weird.
Right. I think it was Eli. I think Eli was the catalyst for this. Because up until this point, Vant had been very open to the idea of some kind of strategic alliance with the chain. And then all of a sudden, Eli's like, no, this ain't right. And I think I'm really impressed. You're absolutely right. Vance is a phenomenal politician. And for him to come out with that, I don't know whether he was already planning to use it or whether it just came to mind because of Eli's response to what she said about the person being free from influence, from her influence. But by him saying that she would have to be tried for her crimes, whatever mask she was wearing, and I'm not on about the green one, went.
Yeah.
And then she became the O'Sara we all know and hate.
Yeah.
So it was a good card to play, and it with the gamble worked, I think.
Yeah. Maybe she was not expecting to be detected as a liar on this thing.
Right.
Well, she had arrived with so much well-prepared goodwill. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, you know, what she was weighing in her favour, that would be the focus.
Yeah. it didn't work.
No, not at all. My quote of the week came from this scene. It nearly came from another one, but I chose not to. When Azira left the conference room, Vance said to Azira, "I can promise you justice." And she said, "Oh, I can promise you the same."
Yeah, doesn't sound too good for the future of both organizations.
Mm. No. Well, I don't know. I think the Federation will probably end up in a better place, in without knowing what we know from the following week's episode. But still, I think whichever organization is able to take the higher ground is going to succeed here.
Yeah.
Because that battle that occurred in that room, Vance won it, no question.
Oh, yeah. Azira arrives back on Discovery's bridge, where Zare, Aurelio, Rin, and Booker are present. She chastises Zare for losing the hostages, especially Stamets, though he protests that they must still be on board. Her harsh language and threats of violence unnerve Aurelio. He tells her there is no need for violence, but she retorts that it is how progress is made, and Aurelio decides to stay. Azira tells Rin to fix the sensors, but he refuses, saying he is no longer afraid of her. She puts her gun to his head, but Booker holds her off by saying he can show her to the Dilithium planet. Azira guesses that it is in the Verubin Nebula, along with Tharu, though Booker tells her the nebula is massive and dangerous, and he can show her how to get there safely. Aurelio notes that she should accept the deal, but Azira quietly turns back and fires on Rin at point-blank range, disintegrating him. Booker is shocked, as is Aurelio, by the bloodshed.
And me.
Yeah, me. But what bloodshed? He's been disintegrated.
Yes, exactly.
Classic green alien move, is what I would say.
Oh, God.
So the fact that the green alien killed a blue alien, that doesn't even things up at all for you.
The other universal constant is, I'm not going to say that because it's wrong. Because we all know about the Kree and they cannot be trusted. So no, I'm just going to tuck my neck in about blue aliens. I was to do a wrong on the internet, but I've restrained myself.
I shall close my XKCD browser.
It's XKCD 386 is what you're looking for.
Yes. XKCD 386.
Oh, if you've not seen it before, it's brilliant. It's so good.
Okay. I will watch this one, read this one later. Azira tells Aurelio to produce a truth theorem so Booker doesn't lie about the planet's location and orders the Viridian to start firing on headquarters shields so they can depart. So back to the good old Azira.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's back.
Ruthless and quick to action.
I believe the words you're looking for are greener than ever.
if we needed subtitles for our episode, we could have picked one of those, like "It's not easy being green" or stuff. Elsewhere, Burnham places Stamets in an emergency escape field and activates her homing beacon. She plans to eject him into space, where the Federation can tractor him to safety. Awakening, Stamets protests, arguing that Kelber and Adira will die painfully if they do not return immediately. But Burnham says that Azira would use him to destroy what remains of the Federation. Leaving a phaser on overload near a window, Burnham exits the room. Stamets angrily shouts that they followed Burnham to the future so she would not be alone. The phaser explodes, rupturing the hull and pulling Stamets inside the escape field into space, where he is tractored to safety by the Federation, as planned. Burnham watches tearfully, but regains her composure. Zare arrives and holds her at gunpoint, telling her she will be sorry for saving Stamets. Those windows are not very strong if they can break with just a phaser exploding.
Yeah.
But they do that all the time. It seems that there might have, some strategic points on the ship where you just have to detonate some phaser or something mildly strong and it would break the ship apart.
I would like to think that those windows are from Nakatomi Plaza.
Yes.
And that's why they broke so easily.
Okay. I can understand that.
I've probably missed that reference.
Die Hard?
It's a callback to the Die Hard reference earlier in the podcast.
Best Christmas movie ever?
I don't watch movies that claim to be Christmas ones that aren't.
It's not a Christmas movie. It's a love story.
Oh my word. I've heard it all now.
At the armory, Tilly and the crew attack the guards and arm themselves. Tilly orders them to make it to the bridge no matter what, meaning fallen comrade must be left behind.
Yeah, go Tilly!
That's leadership. They are surprised when 3.23 drones emerge. One displays an old Earth film, and Tilly realizes they are controlled by the sphere data. The drones confirm her suspicion and offer to help take back the ship. It was nice to see the drones. And it was nice to see Tilly as a real team leader. That reminded me of, I think it's First Contact? The movie when Picard, goes to the armory, takes weapons, and everybody follows him, even though he says, I'm going alone, and they say, no, I'm going with you. And it was kind of the same scene with the crew armed and ready to fight to take the ship back.
I don't remember.
You don't?
No.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm looking for a new co-host for this show. Someone will know. No.
Star Trek. That was film 8. My expertise only goes up to 7.
First Contact was not... Oh, yeah.
Yeah, First Contact was the first one after Generations. It was the first truly TNG film.
Yes.
Nice to hear from Zora.
Yeah, except it's the first time... It's not the first time we hear this voice, because we heard that in one of the short treks.
We also heard it in the episode when Saru had the failed dinner with his crew.
Yes, true.
Because it was Zora's voice we heard when she suggested to Saru that she do the films, the movies.
Yes, but there's no reference to the name.
No, there isn't. You're quite right, unless you had watched Calypso, the Short Treks episode, which I recommend everybody goes and watches, then no, you wouldn't have recognized Zora as the voice.
Yeah, which is why I had removed that from the review.
Ah, fair enough. I've got loads of questions, I really do. .23s can do the Vulcan salute.
Apparently.
Or should I say Nivan salute? I'm not sure whether it's sort of translated yet, but...
But why would they do that? I mean... There's no Vulcan here, so why would they use the Vulcan salute?
Because it's a symbol that the crew would recognize as friendly.
Yeah, isn't it the symbol of first contact as well, as far as sort of Starfleet are concerned?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, hang on a second. It wasn't. It wasn't the Vulcan salute.
No?
It was more like that than it was like that.
Yeah.
Sorry, that doesn't work on an audio podcast.
It was more of a metal. Yeah,
it was more like thingy. The rocking thing than the Vulcan salute. That's Jehovah's Witnesses.
Actually, it's a symbol of the beast, but okay.
Oh, okay. that's I love you in one of the sign languages, but I don't know. Yeah, whatever. But it was nice of them to do a salute.
I can't do the Falcon thing. You know how some people can, you know how some people can roll their tongue and some people are genetically unable to roll their tongue. I am genetically unable to do the whole. Like I actually just cannot do it.
I was surprised that my daughter, who is 5.5-year-old, she came to me last week or the week before, and she did the Vulcan salute. Where did you learn to do that? And she said, well, I saw you do it. And I said, not a lot of people can do it properly from the first time. I know her mother cannot.
My wife can't. Mm. So, yeah. You know, go figure. Yeah.
So I have hopes that she's going to be a Star Trek fan pretty soon.
Well, we need to... first of all, you need to teach her English, and then you need to get her on the show.
Yeah. But she can count in English from 1 to 10, so that's a start.
It is a start, yes, absolutely. Until we get to episode 11, and then we're stuck.
So what other question did you have, Dave?
Do you know what? I don't have loads of questions. I don't know why I even said that, but I do have a few things to mention. It occurred to me that the whole thing about being able to bust an external window... Stop laughing at me. To bust an external window with a phaser. When you travel on public transport here in the UK, or any kind of vessel where the public is able to travel, you have one window in the entire carriage that you can break as a form of emergency exit. And they normally put like a studded hammer or a diamond-tipped hammer mm-hmm. next to it so that you can smash the window and get out. So I wonder whether this particular window that Stamets was jettisoned out of was the emergency exit.
Wow, this is the best example of overthinking I have ever encountered. But
have you
also
never listened to the show before?
Perfectly plausible. You know, in the event you need to evacuate the spaceship into the vacuum of space, the diamond studded hammer is here, and this is the window you need to strike.
Right. Sorry, what? When someone says blow the hatch, where is the hatch going to be? There has to be one.
Yeah.
And it was this window.
Right. I mean, yes. Okay. All joking aside, there's a definite plausibility in this analysis.
Plus, the inside of the ship is pressurized, and outside it's the vacuum of space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you add a little bit of pressure inside, yeah, okay, might be able to blow the window out.
I can't believe you're even entertaining this.
It's not how vacuums work, but okay.
Well, it's called the vacuum of space. But
yeah, I know. People think that vacuums suck and they don't.
No.
Vacuum cleaners suck, but a vacuum does not.
So we have heard back from Andrew, our resident astronomer.
Oh.
And he has done the sums, the hard sums, and we have an answer. So between the current day and 3189,
really counts a long way away.
Mm-hmm. The additional time it would take for the Earth to rotate, so the value we currently call a day, would increase by 27 milliseconds.
Okay. That is the most underwhelming bit of factual information I have ever heard.
Yeah,
and well, that's based on data points collected over the last 1,000 years.
I mean, I don't doubt the accuracy, but I was hoping for at least 27 seconds. I mean, if I'm honest, I was hoping for 27 hours.
Well, at least it's not, you know, 1,000th of a microsecond.
Right. Wow.
No, exactly.
So the galaxy, you know, quite literally moves like clockwork. All you need to do is you need to put an old penny farthing on sort of, you know, the northern tip of the equator.
Right.
And an account for those 27 milliseconds. Isn't that how Big Ben is, you know?
It's exactly how the swing it works. But then would you have to reduce the number of penny farthings that are on the clock?
For all we know, it's the penny farthings we've been putting on, you know, the pendulum of Big Ben that have been throwing the galaxy out of kilter.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, with a drift of 27 milliseconds every millennia.
It's the galactic extension of the butterfly effect.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, thought you'd like that.
Lovely.
Right, I have got a couple of trivia items.
Okay, go ahead.
I know you're desperate to end this episode. I know you are, but...
I was going to ask Martin what he thought about the episode, but you can...
Oh, do that first. Do that first.
Yeah.
So, No. I'm. We've just done the 27 millisecond thing. I think the continuity is let's get the trivia. Let's get the trivia off the back of that as well.
I've got to say, it goes downhill from here.
Oh, dear.
So, first piece of trivia, I think we all would have spotted this. This was a Jonathan Frakes directed episode, and I think it showed.
Yeah.
What were the things that you will have, other than his name at the very beginning of the show, but, you know, what are the characteristics that you think define his directorship?
It was a kick-ass episode.
Right.
Yes.
Simples. It's nothing more than that.
Yeah, he has a track record of directing very, very good episodes. So I don't know if it's him, just him making the episode very good, or if he just picks up the good ones.
Well, he just reads all the scripts and he says, I'll do that one, yeah. and that one.
It could be just that.
It could be. He's only done 3 episodes this season. Well, I say only, that's quite a few, but... This episode has the longest star date in Star Trek franchise history. The star date of this episode, which was, it actually appeared in the Emerald Chain Armistice. You may not have spotted it, just at the right at the top line of the armistice.
It was the first thing I read backwards as I was looking at it.
Ah, okay. So
no, it's not. I didn't spot it.
The star date was 29141429.1.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, the more we're going to move forward, the longer the star date will be, because, well, obviously they're only going up, so...
That is a very good and fair observation.
So pretty much every new episode we're going to have a bigger star date.
No.
No?
No, I disagree, because when we looked at season 1 of TNG, the star dates bounced backwards and forwards through the episode. They weren't chronological in-universe.
That's because at the time they didn't serialize the series. It was, you know, one episode after the other.
That is true.
Can you just repeat that star date, Dave?
29... I've lost it. 29141429.1.
I can exclusively reveal that the galactic drift of planet Earth by that star date is at 28.2 milliseconds.
Excellent. Well, I've never heard galactic drift expressed in time before, but it's quite accurate. and the last piece of trivia was the Andorian opera. So the opera bit we heard when Aurelio was listening to it was actually, believe it or not, written by Jeff Russo, and it was sung by a professional classically trained singer called Ayana Haviv, who I did know where she was from, and I've completely lost it now. But she has done singing for many, many well-known series, including Discovery. She did singing in Star Trek Picard, the Altered Carbon series, which I think was the one with Kiefer Sutherland, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Men in Black International, Bumblebee, the Transformers film, the Exorcist TV series.
All very, very good films.
Yeah, absolutely. Rogue One, the Ghostbusters remake in 2016, the TV series Defiance, which I absolutely adored, the Marvel series Agent Carter. Yeah, she's been in loads and loads of things as a contributing singer. So, cool. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
It was. So, Martin, what did you think of this episode?
I've enjoyed it, ultimately. Discovery is fast becoming one of my favourite Star Trek television series. I love the characters. I miss Christopher Pike. That was a high point for me. And I think there's going to be a spin-off where that character is a centrepiece. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Star Trek Strange New Worlds, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is earmarked for some time this year, but we don't have any clue as to when that might be.
No.
No.
Which
is reasonable, because the world is weird right now.
It is. It is. Yeah, I liked this episode too. It was full of action. It was also full of surprises, as the whole Osara thing, what is she up to and stuff like that. And the comeback of Tilly as, you know, a team leader, justifying her position as the first officer.
Also, she's sassy and is a real quick thinker. You know, great poker face in the face of adversity.
Mm.
Quick comebacks, cutting remarks. There's a captain for the future to be looking out for sure.
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
I agree.
Maybe a spin-off series with her at some point, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I've enjoyed most about this season of Discovery is perhaps what some Star Trek purists do not like. And that's because they flung themselves so far out into the future. They didn't have to stick to all of the, you know, Star Trek lore and convention.
Yep.
And this felt much more like science fiction fantasy that happens to revolve around the Star Trek universe rather than being steeped in its history and lore.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yes.
And also the fact that they sent them 930 years into the future, that leaves room between the Picard time and where they are now to, they might fit another series in there.
Well, there's 700 years, 750 yeah. odd years.
Yeah. Yeah. And they, even in the first couple of episodes, they effectively sort of killed the idea that the Federation had survived all of this. Now, we later learn that there is a small group carrying the banner, but they snuffed out the Federation in a Star Trek TV series, pretty yeah. much. And I do enjoy, I've always enjoyed Star Trek, but I'm not like, you know, a mad Star Trek fan. I just enjoy science fiction. And I suppose this was more science fiction than Star Trek for me. And that was one of the reasons why I've enjoyed it so much.
I almost feel like season 3 is the same characters, but not exactly the same series as the first two seasons.
Yeah.
They took the character, they put them in another settings, and they're starting with a clean plate. And as you said, they can do pretty much whatever they want. And I can understand that some people don't like that. I just don't care. It's still Star Trek anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Dave, what did you think of the episode?
Yeah, I think the episode was fantastic. I think just the right amount of action and storyline, a little bit of kind of vomituous romance to be thrown in to balance thing out slightly. But I felt that the way that the crew came together to defeat a common adversary, and in fact, people beyond the crew, Book and Rin, who had no real link to the Discovery or to Starfleet as a whole, rolled the sleeves up and got involved in defending it. But I suppose they were more defending against a common enemy rather than defending a common vessel.
Or an ideal.
Yeah, or an ideal. That's another a very good way of putting it. But I thought the acting for most of the actors was absolutely spot on. Yeah, my second shout out to Anthony Rapp for the final scene of his when he got jettisoned out of Discovery and picked up by the Federation tractor beam. I thought his acting as a whole throughout the whole of the season has been absolutely brilliant. But I can't single him out. I cannot think of any particular actor throughout the whole of the series that has been any less good than any other.
Yeah,
and the acting and the storylines, the story writing, script writing, and the production for the season so far has just been phenomenal. I've loved this series so far. This episode did not disappoint.
Yeah, I agree. I just wonder if they can top that with, for Picard season 2 and Discovery season 4. So hopefully they've kept the same momentum and they will just give us great episodes for those two upcoming series.
Right. I think that's it. I don't think they need to top it. I think they need to keep it.
Yeah, keep it, yeah.
Because we've mentioned this many times in the past of how Star Trek Discovery has evolved since episode 1 of season 1 to where it is now, and how similar in quality season 3 of Discovery and season 1 of Picard were.
Mm-hmm.
I think Alex Kurtzman and the rest of the production crew and the scriptwriters have kind of found that sweet spot of good story writing, good cinematography, and just the right amount of Star Trek. I'm completely in agreement with what you said earlier on, Martin, about how they've kind of jumped away from Star Trek lore, Star Trek canon, but they've kept the spirit mm-hmm. of Star Trek. They've kept the soul of Gene Roddenberry's vision of Star Trek very much in their sights. But they've taken the opportunity of jumping outside of the originally established canon
mm-hmm.
and made it their own. And this is now a brand new Star Trek. And I think season 3, for me, has rescued Discovery. Not that it was bad, but I think for a lot of people who thought that it was bad at the beginning, I think it's rescued it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think in some respects, Discovery has become what Voyager could have been.
Yeah, I can see that. Voyager being far away in the Delta Quadrant, they could have...
Yeah, Discovery's been thrown far out of time, whereas Voyager was thrown far out of place.
Yes. Well, you know, when we are done reviewing all the live series, maybe we will end up reviewing Voyager. So we're going to...
Oh, I'm on every week. I'm on every week if you do that. But also, it is going to take you like 7 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think my occasional watching of Voyager, you know, like... a couple of episodes here, one episode there, a couple of nights where I didn't watch any. I'm pretty sure it took me over 3 years to get through them all. Like, and that was the only thing I was watching when I was bumbling around.
Hmm.
Well, you know, as you said, if we do Voyager, we can have you every week. It's not a problem for us.
I am such a Voyager bore, though. You don't want me on.
Right, gentlemen, if you... don't have anything to add to this review, then we will end up said review of There Is a Tide. So thanks to all of you for listening to our show. You can help us spread the love for this podcast by putting a piece of paper with our website address on it inside a plastic bottle and shove them out of an airplane window. Or if you think you might get into trouble with the FAA for depressurizing a commercial aircraft mid-flight, you can simply share the address of our website on social media.
And you can find our website at tlgreyhot.org, where you'll find all of the show notes and reviews for every episode we have done a review of. And you can leave a comment at the bottom of every one of our episode show notes.
Should you want to get in contact with us, you can do so by sending us an email at feedback@tlgreyhot.org.
Alternatively, you can send us a message on Twitter or Facebook. Our username for both of these is TEGH Podcast. Thank you very much indeed to Lainey for being our communications officer and keeping those up to date for us. And we're also on Telegram at t.me/TEGH Podcast, which is the only place that you'll get the link to our unlisted YouTube live stream, where you can watch us live as we produce these episodes. And yes, and amazing content appears in these episodes that doesn't go out on the final podcast version. So if you don't watch the live video, you are missing out.
Thanks to Memory Alpha, as always, we have based our review on this week's episode on their work, and this is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution non-commercial license.
The rest of this show is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution share-alike license. See our website for details.
This podcast is part of the Other Side Podcast Network. Check out our website at otherside.network for great content and great shows.
Indeed so. Next week will be our great Discovery Uber extravaganza, as we're going to be assembling as many of our past guests as we possibly can to review Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 13, That Hope Is You, Part 2, which will be the series finale.
Which is the second part of the first episode of the season.
Yeah, it really confused us because they released the names of the first five episodes first, and then they didn't name the remaining eight episodes until about episode 4. So we were trying, where is this Hope Is You Part 2? And then it became the finale. So awesome stuff. And it's a cracking episode.
Indeed. After next week, we were supposed to review Deep Space Nine episode season one, but since Lower Deck will also be released on Amazon Prime, I think it's next week or the week after that, we have decided to review this piece of this amazing animated series instead. So it's we think it's always more interesting to review fresh material rather than, you know, Deep Space Nine that everyone has already seen. So we're going to be reviewing Lower Decks.
We will still adhere to the Twitter vote that we did over the last few weeks, and once we've done Lower Decks, we will then switch to Deep Space Nine Season unless Picard or Strange New Worlds or Section 13 or Prodigy or Picard come along. Because apparently they're all supposed to be out this year.
Yeah, but Picard is, I think they're starting filming now, so there's really no hope that it's going to be out pretty soon.
Mm.
Right, so it's the end of this episode. Thank you, Martin, for joining us once again.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me back.
Where can people find out more about you on the interwebs?
The easiest place to find more about me is on Twitter at @m_wimpress or wimpiesworld.com.
Cool.
Excellent.
Thank you, Dave, for joining us once again.
Of course.
That's it for this week's episode. We will be back next week with a whole lot more Star Trek and a whole bunch of guests. We don't know exactly what we're going to use, if it's it's probably going to be GT or something.
Yep.
In the meantime, take care of yourselves. Ciao, ciao.
See ya.
Bye.
It's running Ubuntu. It should be fine.
You'd think so.
If only we knew someone.
No comment.
It's because it's not running Mate. That's why.
No,
it's
that's
Oh, shut your face.
I think you've missed a paragraph, mate.
Oh, did I? No, I don't think so.
The USS song?
No, I just did that.
I must have fallen asleep.
You blanked out.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, no problem.
Rewind.
You were editing, so.
Am I?
Yeah, you are. Housekeeping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've been listening to a member of the Otherside Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at otherside.network.